Hi, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, and I will be, as always, your host. Today, we'll be speaking with Professor John Burnham about his book that he edited, After Freud Left, A Century of Psychoanalysis in America, published by the University of Chicago Press. It's a book that looks at the intersection of culture and psychoanalysis in the United States, the ways in which culture has an opening for psychoanalysis or does not, and that psychoanalysis in many respects rises or falls on the basis of the cultural surround in which it's situated. The book includes writing by many eminent historians. I'll just list their names quickly: Sanu Shamdasani, Richard Skues, Ernst Falziter, George Macari, Helu Sakshahin, Dorothy Ross, Lou Menand, Elizabeth Lundbeck, and Jean-Christophe Agnew. That's Louis Menand. I don't actually know him, but we read him in The New Yorker and are familiar with him. Dr. Burnham is a very renowned historian of psychoanalysis and of psychology. He's published a plethora of articles on the field of psychoanalysis, and he's been working at writing in the field probably since he began back in the 50s. So we're very pleased to have him with us today. And just one heads up to the listener: during our interview, somehow the phone line went dead, which has never happened before. So you will hear the line go dead, or you'll hear some silence. Just give it 15 seconds. It's not psychoanalytic silence. It's actually technological problems. And I call Dr. Burnham back, and then we resume the interview. So hold tight. And without further ado, let's move on to the interview. Hi, welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. It's Tracy Morgan here again, your host. And today we're very happy to have with us Professor John Burnham, who we'll be speaking to today about his recent publication. It's a series of essays titled After Freud Left, A Century of Psychoanalysis in America, University of Chicago Press. And we've just finished reading the book and have enjoyed it greatly, and we're glad to have you here. So welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis, Dr. Burnham.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I guess I'll begin with one question. I've been doing these interviews for a little over a year and change, and I've been getting feedback, and people have told me that I tend to ask authors what might look like a more clinically oriented question, which is usually something like, what prompted you to write this book? And so as people have said, well, why do you do that? Why don't you just ask them what the book is about? And so I think I'm going to ask you that question. Can you tell the listening audience, what is this book about, After Freud Left?
After Freud Left is a series of invited essays that fell together just beautifully to make a beginning of a history of psychoanalysis in the United States after Freud's famous visit, 1909. There was a century, so we use a century mark for it. Mm-hmm. The book consists of essays by leading historians of psychoanalysis and leading cultural historians of the United States. And I'm happy to say that of the people invited, only one refused, and that was certainly excusable. These were absolutely wonderful people, each with a very different take on it, mm-hmm. and yet they all worked together and produced this book After Freud Left.
And when you said that they were invited, so you extended the invitations. You said, okay, these are the people I want to hear from, and how did it come together? I mean, you know, some people are writing about the early part of the century, some are writing, you know, in the post-war period. How did people decide, you know, think about what it was that they were going to contribute? Because the book reads really, it's quite a nice, has a nice narrative arc to it. and given that you have so many different contributors, that would not necessarily be how things might work out. So can you talk a bit about that? Because you, because it does have a good narrative arc and yet many different historians.
I'm sorry to tell you, in one word, it was an accident.
There's no such thing as a mistake, you know, Freud said. So,
but each author is asked to write reflections on something that he or she would think about. What happened, you know, what about a century has passed since Freud visited the United States? Mm-hmm. No, you know, they were given carte blanche, and when the essays came in, they just fell into chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a couple of places where there are, I would consider, big gaps, but that's another story.
Well, that's an interesting story, because as I read the book, there were moments where I thought, oh, what about this or what about that? What would you say the gaps were? Because there's certainly a lot more that can be written on this topic.
The two major gaps that I noticed, and I think others did as well, the 1920s and 30s rise of the culture and personality school, when social scientists took up psychoanalytic thinking. And this was extremely powerful in the United States, dominating.
Yep.
And the second big gap that we all noticed was the end of the 20th century, in a way that is just too recent for people to have addressed comfortably. They ventured into it, some of the essayists. But there are a number of factors. One is, did psychoanalysis actually fade out? A second factor is, you know, this is very recent. We're getting into very current debates, and that's very difficult to get a handle on for an historian, or at least for most historians.
Sure.
And finally, it's just, we don't have the background material in cultural history for the turn of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I noticed there was one area that I was curious about, and maybe this is jumping a bit ahead into sort of thinking about the moment of 1968. I always think that things really change in psychoanalysis in response to, and I'm using 1968 in quotes, you know, sort of as a historical moment. And I found it interesting in the book that what's not written about is a uniquely American school. I mean, we have Kohut, and there's Elizabeth Lundbeck has written a fascinating chapter about, you know, about the rise of Kohut and his theories of narcissism and how they were interacting with the culture of narcissism, you know, with the 70s and with the turn inward and away from the social. But there was another movement called relational psychoanalysis, which is really very, very popular, and it's a homegrown American product, mostly out of the New York University postdoc program in psychoanalysis. And they champion some very American ideas, and in their journal, in fact, they had an issue in 2004 where they asked the question, what's American about American psychoanalysis? And they're known for their interest in counter-transferential transparency, the dethroning of the analyst as king, for the idea that perhaps democratically the analyst and patient co-create the analytic understandings that come out of the treatment. And I was curious, because I thought, oh, this wasn't written about. Is it because it's just too recent? I mean, it is about a 30-year-old movement, perhaps, and it seems like a very American phenomena.
I think probably as close as any of the essays got was to allude to changes in ideas about the self.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as you correctly pointed out, we summarized 1968, et cetera, by saying that people, intellectuals, started writing about the personal as opposed to the social or whatever. But we can go on from there and, talk about the changes in itself, which is a whole literature in its own.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the essayists seriously took up, there are a couple of footnotes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
None of them seriously took up the challenge of writing about the changes in the idea of the self.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people define it differently. But certainly something happened around the 1970s period.
Right. Yeah, I would say so, because there's a lot of there's a move, interestingly, sort of chronologically, we begin with a psychoanalysis that has the idea of it's a one person psychology. There's one person in the room, and there's one psyche in the room, and that's the patients. And this movement, very much democratically oriented, says there are two people in the room interacting with each other, impacting each other, and possibly, it's of course it's a critique of authority, which is what we could say 1968 certainly brought to bear in the culture at large, that there was an attempt to make to critique the powers that be for the problems that that these analysts were training or becoming analysts, they were often trained by more of the authoritarian ego psychology school, and they rebelled mm-hmm. against that. And created this this other movement, which is I don't know, maybe we have to write a chapter on that someplace
well,
else.
I'm sorry, Tracy. If I'd known, I would have certainly invited you to contribute a chapter.
Well, you would if I could still write history. I don't know. But yeah, it is interesting to think about what's America. Because part of what the book looks at is how American culture has room for or does not have room for, at various moments, psychoanalytic thinking, and how chameleon-like, how the psychoanalysis can be used by so many different social forces.
And it can be diluted endlessly.
Yes.
That's one of the questions which is raised in this book. How much do you have to dilute it before it ceases to be psychoanalysis or Freud?
Right. Can you say some more about that? I think this is something that a lot of analysts are struggling with currently.
The model, of course, was American eclecticism. The American model was, we are distant over here, away from Europe, and so we can pick and choose the best from the Europeans and not be caught up with... And this goes back to the 18th century, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a tradition. And this was the accepted way. What is fair? Everyone has to be recognized... very democratic, and so we will pick and choose the best from whatever there is and not exclude anybody, including psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, for the Freudians of the mid-20th century and for Freud himself, what this meant was that people missed the structure that underlay the intellectual structure that underlay psychoanalytic practice and psychoanalytic thinking in general. I mean, how can you have how can you have drive theory without sex?
Right.
Which is, you know, you pick and choose, and many people tried to. And this was the general direction that things were going in the late 20th century. There were all these different schools, and all of them saying, oh, we're psychoanalysts, and we still have that. Maybe they are all psychoanalysts. The larger question probably is, what really was Freud's legacy?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, his legacy was many things to many people, but it doesn't make it any the less Freud's or any the less a legacy.
That really does come across in the book as well. How Americans have made use of psychoanalysis. I was someplace recently and talking about an attack in the New York Times had printed a piece saying, you know, still in therapy, enough already, underneath a photograph of Freud's couch. And so this caused an uproar, and people were not happy and were writing into the New York Times, and I was with some analysts from a different institute than the one I'm affiliated with, and talking about this campaign of letter writing, getting analysts to speak up and say, you know, this is clearly an attack on the profession. And the person who wrote the opinion page touted a 28-day cure sort of thing and poo-pooed psychoanalysis. But as I was speaking to these analysts, you know, I've used the word unconscious a lot. And I use the word psychoanalysis a lot. And I said, you know, we have to defend and protect the existence of the unconscious. And one analyst said, and she's, you know, from a graduate from a major institute, I'm not very comfortable with the use of the word unconscious. I think we have to talk more in terms of attachment and meaning. And so here we are. And I'm staring across the room wondering, do we do the same thing? Do we... Are we coming from the same place? Because there is such profound eclecticism here.
And it is of all degrees. The school which came out of the... there's a school of... I don't know what it's... It may be another version of Kohut. Yes.
Hi, I think the line went down.
I don't know what happened.
Oh, my goodness. Well, hold on. I've never had this happen. we just had a little bit of silence, and that's... we'll just pick it up from where we were. You were saying there's a school that it was related to the Kohutians,
well,
I think.
With this emphasis on... without going into the background, the emphasis on siblings as opposed to parents, if you want to say, one of the major questions was, can you have Freud without the Oedipus complex?
Right.
And this is a major question, and you can have differences of opinion like that.
Well, there certainly are, and some would say, I think the French analysts say about the Americans that we've desexualized Freud, that we've taken the drive, the libido, and infantile sexuality out of the Freudian pantheon, and so hence, are we really doing psychoanalysis?
Well, I think if you look at the cognitive revolution, which came in the late 20th century,
mm-hmm.
that you can see that there was a basic approach to dynamic thinking, the internal conflicts, biologically based mm-hmm. and environmentally based. Mm-hmm. These conflicts playing themselves out, that's the dynamic approach. And that is what has been denied in the wake of the cognitive revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There was a story of one teacher who was trying to teach a little Freud to his college class, and the students were unable to comprehend the idea of unconscious. They just could not comprehend that there could be an unconscious. They had feelings and so on, but everything did not hang together with this other biological base in a, for a drive theory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of problem that makes people say, well, what about the, what about Freud? Is he really dead? And I think that gives us an idea. If you can find any evidence of dynamic thinking and not trace it anywhere else, it's very likely still left over from Freud. But
mm-hmm.
that would be a fun thing to track down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting the fate of the unconscious or the ability to acknowledge that there is an unconscious. We talk about that a lot, I think, how it's been kind of wiped out. It makes people uneasy. I mean, psychoanalysis should make people uneasy, I think, because it is it does talk about uneasy making topics. I think I wanted to ask you about this. I was thinking that a lot of people may not know who are listening that the medicalization of psychoanalysis, the request that a person have an MD, be a psychiatrist, is a pretty uniquely American phenomena. And as you're a scholar of psychoanalysis in America, I was wondering if you could speak to us about how the medicalization of psychoanalysis in America, how you understand its comeuppance and how it came about.
You mean the end of medicalization?
Well, there's the end of it, but that rather we began, at least this is my understanding, and it was upsetting to Freud and to Ferenczi and to many, but that the push, for instance, of the New York psychoanalytic, you know, some of the more early institutes that were founded wanted there to be MDs, isn't that correct?
Yes,
they would train.
The MD was required.
The MD was required. I think there's a lot of confusion. I think about this, like why, what was the need for the MDs? Because you don't see this in Europe. You know, you're not reading analysts in Europe and going, "Oh, he's an MD." That's it's almost rare to find. Can you help the audience to understand why we went the medical route at psychoanalysis's beginnings in this country?
There are a couple of reasons historically. Of course, it was a way of keeping fringe characters out of psychoanalysis. That's one thing. The second thing is, people in the United States really believed that medical degree was important. And I have heard it argued within this past year by a senior psychoanalyst that, yes, people can do technical psychoanalysis and carry it off, but without that medical training, whatever is involved in it, there's a whole dimension that is missing. And certainly among the analysts of the mid-20th century, they had a strong feeling that the mind, whatever was being analyzed, was based in the body. And I was deeply impressed by how quickly the really good analysts would refer a patient to the neurologist rather than just carrying on,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Rather than saying, well, it's all in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one sees dramatic cases in which the clinically experienced physician doing psychoanalysis picks up on, in one case that I saw, Pick's disease,
mm-hmm.
which would not really be known even to a very well-trained lay analyst.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is just a whole approach. The patient is a medical patient, and it's, of course, the other historical force was the entrance of psychologists,
right.
well-trained psychologists, into psychoanalysis, encouraged in the 1940s by government fellowships and government programs, because there just weren't enough people, and these were very talented people, the psychologists were.
Mm-hmm. I believe they had to, does it come up in the book that that there was a lawsuit, right, against the American Psychoanalytic, led by psychologists so as to gain admission, you know, and now we see actually at the, for instance, here in New York City, the New York Psychoanalytic is, I believe, accepting people with social work licenses. I don't think that, someone told me that they didn't have anyone with a social work license at the moment in training there, perhaps, but that's really quite a change from where they began with A.A. Brill all those years ago with the medical doctors. But I've never heard that explanation that you gave, that the MD can tell the difference between an organic illness and unconscious conflict as a reason.
Well, some psychologists, you know, first-rate psychologists doing analysis simply make a physical exam by a neurologist
mm-hmm.
Required before they will undertake a full analysis.
Yeah, yeah. So just safeguarding everyone. But you also mentioned that there was a fear of the fringe. What would that fringe have been? What was it in the early days of the advent of American of psychoanalysis in America? Who was that fringe?
Well, you know, anybody could set up. I've recently published about the case of the anthropologist A.L. Kroeber, who simply set himself up as a psychoanalyst in San Francisco in 1920.
Hmm.
I'm sure he said he's just. He was very smart, and he said that he was as qualified as most of the MDs doing that work
mm-hmm.
because he was intelligent, he could read, and he understood, and he was well-read, and he had had a little psychoanalysis, not much.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know, whatever was customary in that day. But here's someone who just put up the shingle, psychoanalyst, and the patients would come.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. It's a question of what, how does one become an analyst, and when is one ready to be an analyst? Because certainly there's many MDs, I guess, who don't have a particular. Well, some, I mean, some have particular gifts as analysts, and.
They don't have particular gifts with patients at all.
Yes, and so exactly. Better you say it than me. So yeah, and I've met both, and have wondered, like, you're an analyst? Are you sure? You know, c'est la vie. But you, one of the things that I was rereading in preparation for the interview, I was going through a book I'm sure you know well by Nathan Hale, The Rise and Crisis of Psychoanalysis in the United States. And I was thinking that at the end of his book, follows from 1917 to 1985, the profession here. And my sense is that he says the profession was in a state of disarray and decline at that point because of the strident demands, at least this is my reading of it, the strident demands imposed by positivism, by, you know, Karl Popper's critique, etc. And I was thinking that your book suggests something different, that the decline seems to have less to do with a debate about science and research and scientific proof of the, you know, is psychoanalysis a science? So how do you think in your book the reasons for the decline of the position of psychoanalysis in the culture are understood?
Okay, let me just say that the DSM-3 in 1980 and the changes in insurance have damaged classical psychoanalytic practice more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's also affected psychiatry in general. I think it's the first time that a formal economic change has shaped a whole medical practice. I don't know of any other time when economics determined medical practice.
Mm-hmm.
But the essayists in the book generally are measuring, in the late 20th century, are measuring intellectual impact. How explicitly do people talk about psychoanalytic ideas?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're examining texts, and I think they're examining the conversations they hear and the papers they read.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they are also saying they're very much aware of how Freud was everyday conversation and Freudianism pervaded everyday conversation in the mid-20th century among intellectuals. And of course that reflected itself in the popular realm as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're just having a series of old films which show psychiatric treatment, supposedly, or people will write about the history of Freud in the theater, which goes way back.
Well, what is, it's funny, in reading the book, I was struck by, how psychoanalytic ideas seem to be adding so much to the fields of sociology, anthropology. Even perhaps, we had probably more, I wonder if there was more writing and from psychohistorians then, the mid-century, than now. The names Marcuse, Norman O'Brown, Lionel Trilling, Alfred Kazin, they all come to mind, and they're peppered throughout the book, and you realize these are some major thinkers mid-century in a variety of fields, really taking seriously Freudian thought. How would you describe the status, or maybe it's the fate, of psychoanalysis in the academy currently?
Well, what's happened is I think it's moved.
Uh-huh. Where did it go?
It has gone from psychology, where it used to be much better entrenched than it is now, although there are still 3,000 members of the psychoanalytic division of the American Psychological Association.
Yep.
Where it has gone has been to film studies and to interdisciplinary humanities and other interdisciplinary programs which are not well defined and not well organized, but there are a lot of them, mm-hmm. and they're very well supported.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another factor that's come in. Most well-trained analysts have always held that Freud made a great break when he decided that he was not seeing neuroses that were caused by trauma, but was seeing neuroses which developed out of internal drives and experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the trauma has come back. And people talk a lot now about trauma. And you particularly hear this, I find, in humanities and film studies. It's an odd place.
Yeah.
I'm not myself currently up on this, and none of our essayists took this up in any serious way. As I say, it's a great gap in the book.
I think, there really has been a turn from unconscious conflict to real-life trauma, and possibly a turn away from repression to the term dissociation. So you really see that as popular on the American scene. Anyway, I don't think as popular in England or France, or certainly not, I don't think, in Argentina. But here we do focus on trauma. We seem to be interested in what really happened, rather than what the individual made of what happened. And it's curious that other formulations of Freudian thought that aren't about trauma are having a hard time, I think, if I understand what you're saying, that they don't really have, they're not really getting much play, the drives, the conflicts, the Oedipal situation. I wonder, do you have any thoughts about the turn toward trauma?
Well, my immediate speculation is this is so much like the very early days, right around 1900. It's so strikingly like it that I wonder if there's going to be some new person come along and discover that it's not trauma that's causing problems, but some internal drive and structure.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I can just imagine someone doing exactly now what Freud did 100 years ago.
This is a fascinating idea. Can you say more? I mean,
well, for a long time, people understood that the trauma the hidden memory was the cause of the illness. And this is what I'm hearing now. We don't need to go into the unconscious. All you have to do is to take this traumatized person and see if we can treat that. And they're using similar things with cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I know history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure has a very strong ghost sometimes.
Well, there is something, I know you know about it, the repetition compulsion. You think it's time for us to have someone come in and talk about the invisible rather than the visible, and to bring back those sorts of ideas about the unconscious and the drives, things that can't be seen, measured, or known so transparently.
Well, many people are aware of the writings of Eric Kandel, who's trying to find another biological basis.
That's right.
So, I mean, instead of finding it in the environment, it will go back to the biological, even if it's genetic.
Interesting.
But that's the way we are now.
Right, right. That I think you described the moment well. Are you trained as an analyst by any chance?
I'm sorry?
Are you trained as a psychoanalyst as well as being a historian?
No. I've never even been analyzed.
Well, it's never too late. When are you going to start?
I'd have to go to the medical school first.
Well, I think you've really been studying. This is not your first book on things psychoanalytic, is it? I believe you have.
No. I worked for many years on the early years of psychoanalysis in the United States, and I investigated the history of Freud's instinct theory, and I've done a number of things. But after all, this is not my book. This is a book written by very gifted essayists.
And some very, and I think for, there's some well-known names in the book to people who aren't historians. I mean, particularly Louis Menand, who is, you know, a public intellectual of sorts, writing, regularly for the New Yorker. His name really jumped out. And Dorothy Ross has, been at this for quite a long time. You know, working around Freud and modernism. I believe, if my memory is correct. Her essay is fabulous. Really, a terrific essay. What is it titled? Let me see here. She really creates this cultural surround. Freud and the Vicissitudes of Modernism in the United States, 1940 to 1980, in which she goes on about the Apollonian and the Dionysian uses of Freud, which is such a wonderful breakdown of how these different thinkers used Freudian ideas. And Elizabeth Lundbeck, who wrote The Psychiatric Persuasion, I believe, which people may know that book. They were names that jumped out at me, right away, and I was very excited to get to read them. But you've been studying things Freudian for so long, but you never decided to go and become an analyst.
No, I don't want to cure anybody. But I have watched analysts or clinicians work, and I deeply admire the work that they do. Mm-hmm. And I highly value it. Mm-hmm. But of course, we have in this book the other part, not just the clinical, but we have the intellectuals who are so powerfully affected. As you mentioned, Dorothy Ross describes it, and Louis Menand describes anxiety,
yep,
which was so pervasive in post-war period.
And there's also an interesting story about, I'm not sure whose essay it's in, but I'm thinking about the moment when the American psychoanalytic wants to leave the International. And so this was in, I guess, the 30s, right? Is that correct?
1938, yeah.
Yeah, they want to leave and sort of defect and no longer have that relationship, and then suddenly it's the Anschluss. It's the here comes Hitler, and a fascinating moment in
the same committee that was trying to make terms with the International was suddenly forced to deal with the refugees.
Right.
It's very dramatic. Yes, that's in George Macari's essay.
That's it, right.
And he, of course, has written this great book on the origins of psychoanalysis.
Yeah. But it was an incredible moment because so many analysts who we know here, Clara Thompson, I don't know, my mind is drawing a blank at the moment, but so many analysts who came over were the exact people that the Americans were saying, no, we're stepping away, and we're not going to over the issue of medicalization of the need to have an MD, I believe. So those same people came over to really plant seeds, psychoanalytic seeds in this culture that wasn't perhaps really ready to have them. Some of those ideas that they brought, that those European analysts brought with them.
Well, they're very attuned to philosophy and theory, mm-hmm. and they did deeply affect Americans in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They certainly were very talented intellectuals, very well educated in the classical way,
mm-hmm.
in European culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think it greatly upgraded things, but there were some very smart Americans too.
Mm-hmm. Who comes to mind?
Lawrence Kuby,
mm-hmm.
for example, who all of that, his generation, you know, very smart.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, one of the things that happened was that the American intellectual establishment recognize the quality of these people. And that's one of the reasons that psychoanalysis made so much progress so fast. It's simply the ability of American intellectuals to recognize quality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to put it.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing particularly subtle about that. The content of what they were saying was in some ways not so important as just the quality of it,
mm-hmm.
quality of the thinking. And that Americans could recognize and accept that is an interesting and curious phenomenon in itself.
Mm-hmm. How do you understand that phenomena, that they were able to take in these people who they were attempting to separate from at the same time? I mean, it's a curious moment.
They were very intelligent. And the other thing is that psychoanalysis has had a huge intellectual framework undergirding. And if you recognize the power of that thinking, and it was classical Aristotelian thinking,
mm-hmm.
Applied to very un-Aristotelian problems. but they saw the power of it. They were convinced.
Mm-hmm.
People who brush Freud off in a superficial way really don't come off very well.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Interesting. To think about. I wanted to ask you, there's a focus, I think, in the book that's looking at, that looks at what the intellectuals are thinking as a measure of what's happening culturally. I think I have a quote from you. You say, altogether, if one reads the record, for a century, intellectuals did provide the best measure and indicator of the impact of Freud. And I wanted to ask, that's interesting, right? Because it's there's not another cultural measure that comes to mind for thinking about Freud's impact on American culture. Is it because the intellectuals were so... They just had such output that you couldn't look at other cultural measures? For instance, I'm just thinking of television, film, radio, other...
Well, when you get on a popular level, it's very often derivative from the intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we pay intellectuals to do.
Oh, well, so with the publication of this book, what are you doing? How would you like to see it go? I mean, because this book is, it's being reviewed. I mean, as I mentioned, Dr. Burnham and I had a brief phone call earlier today just to check on something, and I mentioned to him that in a local publication in Brooklyn called the Brooklyn Rail, his book is reviewed. and it has a nice photograph, you know, of the book, and it's a very overall very positive review. And I said, "What is this doing here? What a surprise, you know, to see this here." So what would you like to see the impact of this book be?
I'd like to see the power of the contributors, who are first-rate intellectuals, mm-hmm. and they represent the very best. They're at the top of their field. I'd like to see their thinking make an impression. People understand. We aren't caught up in the old Freud wars of pro and con, Freud, etc. Mm-hmm. That we can now really take a measure of what happened in the last century.
Well,
and it's being done by people whom anybody can recognize as being of the first-rate quality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I sense that this book was, you know, the way you just described it, it was like we're now beyond the Freud wars. Can you give us a quick recap? What are the Freud wars? Because I don't know that everyone listening is going to know.
Oh.
And how did we get beyond them?
Okay. Very quickly, the Freud wars grew out of a reaction, partly out of anti-authoritarian post-1960s, partly out of just a natural reaction, because Freud had been made so much of and had been praised so much that there was bound to be some reaction. But people started making ad hominem arguments.
Mm.
You know, did Freud smoke too much? If so, that means that psychoanalytic ideas are invalid. And that's the logic that was involved.
Uh-huh.
And of course, people came in on the other side and it got very ugly. I thought it was not productive of anything good.
Right.
And a lot of us just stayed out. And now that's all dead. The new Freud studies, of which this book is a good example, is saying we don't have to deal with all of that. We're dealing with what actually happened, the power of psychoanalytic ideas, and what happened to them, and what that tells us not only about psychoanalytic ideas, but about the culture itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. That's well put. And it is something to think that not too long ago, those Freud wars were really still on fire. I think that there was the big argument about the, what was it, the Smithsonian, right? Back in
the Library of Congress.
In
the mid-90s.
Yeah, that was like the last throwdown. You know, that was really
nobody wanted to have anything to do with that.
Right.
It was just very ugly and so on. So what we have now are the new Freud studies, and they are fresh. They're different. I think it's generational.
Mm-hmm.
But it's international.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I think this book represents the kind of scholarship we're going to have on Freud now.
Well, that's that's exciting and welcome, because it's really very thought-provoking, and I enjoyed the book very much, and I'm hoping that the listeners out there will go out and get a copy, because I think to begin to think about our history as analysts and our future, you know, this book, it provides a terrific, terrific grounding and has marvelous stories contained within it of what ways in which psychoanalysis on the American scene has flourished, has perished, has come back again, and it was a terrific read. I think we're a little bit over our 50-minute hour because we did lose contact for a moment there. I don't know what happened to the phone, but I want to thank you very much, Dr. Burnham, for joining us today, New Books in Psychoanalysis.
Thank you.
And keep us posted if you're going to be publishing another psychoanalytically oriented book, because we'd love to talk to you again. Okay. All right. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you.